Continuation of the President's State of the Union Address to the 87th Congress, January the 11th, 1962.
In the coming year, our reserve programs will be revised. Two Army divisions will, I hope, replace those Guard divisions on duty, and substantial other increases will boost our Air Force fighter units, the procurement of equipment, and our continental defense and warning efforts. The nation's first serious civil defense shelter program is underway, identifying, marking, and stocking 50 million spaces. And I urge your approval of federal incentives for the construction of public fallout shelters in schools and hospitals and similar centers. But arms alone are not enough to keep the peace. It must be kept by men. Our instrument and our hope is the United Nations, and I see little merit in the impatience of those who would abandon this imperfect world instrument because they dislike our imperfect world. For the troubles of a world organization merely reflect the troubles of the world itself. And if the organization is weakened, these troubles can only increase. We may not always agree with every detailed action taken by every officer of the United Nations, or with every voting majority, but as an institution, it should have in the future, as it has had in the past since its inception, no stronger or more faithful member than the United States of America. In 1961, the peacekeeping strength of the United Nations was reinforced, and those who preferred or predicted its demise, envisioning a troika in the seat of Hammersholt or Red China inside the assembly, have seen instead a new vigor under a new Secretary General and a fully independent Secretariat. In making plans for a new forum and principles on disarmament, for peacekeeping in outer space, for a decade of development effort, the UN fulfilled its charter's lofty aims. 18 months ago, the tangled and turbulent Congo presented the UN with its gravest challenge. The prospect was one of chaos, or certain big power confrontation with all of its hazards and all of its risks to us and to others. Today, the hopes have improved for peaceful conciliation within a united Congo. This is the objective of our policy in this important area. No policeman is universally popular, particularly when he uses his stick to restore law and order on his beat. Those members who are willing to contribute their votes and their views, but very little else, have created a serious deficit by refusing to pay their share of special UN assessments. Yet they do pay their annual assessments to retain their votes, and a new UN bond issue financing special operations for the next 18 months is to be repaid with interest from these regular assessments. This is clearly in our interest. It will not only keep the UN solvent, but require all voting members to pay their fair share of its activities. Our share of special operations has long been much higher than our share of the annual assessment, and the bond issue will, in effect, reduce our disproportionate obligation. And for these reasons, I am urging Congress to approve our participation. With the approval of this Congress, we have undertaken in the past year a great new effort in outer space. Our aim is not simply to be first on the moon, any more than Charles Lindbergh's real aim was to be first to Paris. His aim was to develop the techniques and the authority of this country and other countries in the field of the air and the atmosphere. And our objective in making this effort, which we hope will place one of our citizens on the moon, is to develop in a new frontier of science, commerce, and cooperation the position of the United States and the free world. This nation belongs among the first to explore it, and among the first, if not the first, we shall be. We are offering know-how and cooperation to the United Nations. Our satellite will soon be providing other nations with improved weather observation. And I shall soon send to the Congress a measure to govern the financing and operation of an international communication satellite system in a manner consistent with the public interest and our foreign policy. But peace in space will help us naught once peace on Earth is gone. World order will be secured only when the whole world has laid down these weapons, which seem to offer us present security, but threaten our future survival of the human race. That armistice day seems very far away. The vast resources of this planet are being devoted more and more to the means of destroying instead of enriching human life. But the world was not meant to be a prison in which man awaits his executioner. Nor has mankind survived the tests and the trials of thousands of years to surrender everything, including its existence, now. This nation has the will and the faith to make a supreme effort to break the logjam on disarmament and nuclear tests, and we will persist until we prevail, until the rule of law has replaced the ever-dangerous use of force. I turn now to a prospect of great promise, our hemispheric relations. The Alliance for Progress is being rapidly transformed from proposal to program. Last month in Latin America, I saw for myself the quickening of hope, the revival of confidence, the new trust in our country, among workers and farmers, as well as diplomats. We have pledged our help in speeding their economic, educational, and social progress. The Latin American republics have, in turn, pledged a new and strenuous effort of self-help and self-reform. To support this historic undertaking, I am proposing, under the authority contained in the last bills of the last session of the Congress, a special long-term Alliance for Progress fund of $3 billion. Combined with our Food for Peace, Export-Import Bank, and other resources, this will provide more than $1 billion a year in new support for the Alliance. In addition, we have increased 12-fold our Spanish and Portuguese language broadcasting in Latin America and improved hemispheric trade and defense. And while the blight of communism has been increasingly exposed and isolated in the Americas, liberty has scored again. The people of the Dominican Republic, with our firm encouragement and help, and those of our sister republics of this hemisphere, are safely passing through the treacherous course from dictatorship through disorder towards democracy. Our efforts to help other new or developing nations and to strengthen their standards for freedom have also made progress. A new unified agency for international development is reorienting our foreign assistance to emphasize long-term development loans instead of grants, more economic aid instead of military, individual plans to meet the individual needs of the nations, and new standards on what they must do to marshal their own resources. A newly conceived Peace Corps is winning friends and helping people in 14 countries. Supplying trained and dedicated young men and women to give these new nations a hand in building a society and a glimpse of the best that is in our country. If there is a problem here, it is that we cannot supply the spontaneous and mounting demand. A newly expanded Food for Peace program is feeding the hungry of many lands with the abundance of our productive farms, providing lunches for children in school, wages for economic development, relief for the victims of flood and famine, and a better diet for millions whose daily bread is their chief concern. These programs help people, and by helping people, they help freedom. The views of their governments may sometimes be very different from ours, but events in Africa, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe teach us never to write off any nation as lost to the communists. That is the lesson of our time. We support the independence of those newer or weaker states whose history, geography, economy, or lack of power impels them to remain outside entangling alliances, as we did for more than a century. For the independence of nations is a bar to the communist grand design. It is the basis of our own. In the past year, for example, we have urged a neutral and independent Laos, regained there a common policy with our major allies, and insisted that a ceasefire precede negotiations. While a workable formula for supervising its independence is still to be achieved, both the spread of war, which might have involved this country also, and a communist occupation, have thus far been prevented. A satisfactory settlement in Laos would also help to achieve and safeguard the peace in Vietnam, where the foe is increasing his tactics of terror, where our own efforts have been stepped up, and where the local government has initiated new programs and reforms to broaden the base of resistance. The systematic aggression now bleeding that country is not a war of liberation. For Vietnam is already free. It is a war of attempted subjugation, and it will be resisted. Finally, the united strength of the Atlantic community has flourished in the last year under severe tests. NATO has increased both the number and the readiness of its air, ground, and naval units, both its nuclear and non-nuclear capabilities. Even greater efforts by all of its members are still required. Nevertheless, our unity of purpose and will has been, I believe, immeasurably strengthened. The threat to the brave city of Berlin remains. In these last 6 months, the Allies have made it unmistakably clear that our presence in Berlin, our free access thereto, and the freedom of 2 million West Berliners would not be surrendered, either to force or through appeasement. And to maintain those rights and obligations, we are prepared to talk when appropriate and to fight if necessary. Every member of NATO stands with us in a common commitment to preserve this symbol of free men's will to remain free. I cannot now predict the course of future negotiations over Berlin. I can only say that we are sparing no honorable effort to find a peaceful and mutually acceptable resolution of this problem. I believe such a resolution can be found, and with it an improvement in our relations with the Soviet Union, if only the leaders in the Kremlin will recognize the basic rights and interests involved and the interest of all mankind in peace. But the Atlantic community is no longer concerned with purely military aims. As its common undertakings grow at an ever-increasing pace, we are and increasingly will be partners in aid, trade, defense, diplomacy, and monetary affairs. The emergence of the new Europe is being matched by the emergence of new ties across the Atlantic. It is a matter of undramatic daily cooperation, and hundreds of workaday tasks, of currencies kept in effective relation, of development loans meshed together, of standardized weapons, and concerted diplomatic positions. The Atlantic community grows, not like a volcanic mountain by one mighty explosion, but like a coral reef from the accumulating activity of all. Thus, we in the free world are moving steadily towards unity and cooperation in the teeth of that old Bolshevik prophecy. and at the very time when extraordinary rumbles of discord can be heard across the Iron Curtain. It is not free societies which bear within them the seeds of inevitable disunity. On one special problem of great concern to our friends and to us, I'm proud to give the Congress an encouraging report. Our efforts to safeguard the dollar are progressing. In the 11 months preceding last February 1st, we suffered a net loss of nearly $2 billion in gold. In the 11 months that followed, the loss was just over $500 million. And our deficit in our basic transactions with the rest of the world, trade, defense, foreign aid, and capital, excluding volatile short-term flows, has been reduced from $2 billion for 1960 to about one-third that amount for 1961. Speculative fever against the dollar is ending, and confidence in the dollar has been restored. We did not and could not achieve these gains through import restrictions, troop withdrawals, exchange controls, dollar devaluation, or choking off domestic recovery. We acted not in panic, but in perspective. But the problem is not yet solved. Persistently large deficits would endanger our economic growth and our military and defense commitments abroad. Our goal must be a reasonable equilibrium in our balance of payments. With the cooperation of the Congress, business, labor, and our major allies, that goal can be reached. We shall continue to attract foreign tourists and investment to our shores, to seek increased military purchases here by our allies, to minimize the outflow of dollars involved in our own military efforts, to maximize foreign aid procurements from American firms, to urge increased aid from other fortunate nations to the less fortunate, to seek tax laws which do not favor investment in other industrialized nations or tax havens, and to urge coordination of allied fiscal and monetary policies so as to discourage large and disturbing capital movements. Above all, if we are to pay for our commitments abroad, we must expand our exports. Our businessmen must be export conscious and export competitive. Our tax policies must spur modernization of our plants. Our wage and price gains must be consistent with productivity to hold the line in prices, and our export credit and promotion campaigns for American industry must continue to expand. But the greatest challenge of all is posed by the growth of the European common market. Assuming the accession of the United Kingdom, there will arise across the Atlantic a trading partner behind a single external tariff similar to ours, with an economy which nearly equals our own. Will we in this country adapt our thinking to these new prospects and patterns, or will we wait until events have passed us by? This is the year to decide. The Reciprocal Trade Act is expiring. We need a new law, a wholly new approach, and a bold new instrument of American trade policy. Our decision could well affect the unity of the West, the course of the Cold War, and the economic growth of our nation for a generation to come. If we move decisively, our factories and farms can increase their sales to their richest, fastest growing market. Our exports will increase, our balance of payment position will improve, and we will have forged across the Atlantic a trading partnership with vast resources for freedom. If, on the other hand, we hang back in deference to local economic pressures, we will find ourselves cut off from our major allies. Industries, and I believe this is most vital, industries will move their plants and jobs and capital inside the walls of the common market. And jobs, therefore, will be lost here in the United States if they cannot otherwise compete for its consumers. Our farm surpluses and our balance of trade, as you all know, to Europe, the common market in farm products is nearly 3 or 4 to 1 in our favor, amounting to one of the best earners of dollars in our balance of payment structure. And without entrance to this market, without the ability to enter it, our farm surpluses will pile up in the Middle West, tobacco in the South, other commodities which have gone through Western Europe for 15 years. Our balance of payment position will worsen. Our consumers will lack a wider choice of goods at lower prices. And millions of American workers whose jobs depend on the sale or the transportation or the distribution of exports or imports, or whose jobs will be endangered by the movement of our capital to Europe, or whose jobs can be maintained only in an expanding economy, these millions of workers in your home states and mine will see their real interests sacrificed. Members of the Congress, the United States did not rise to greatness by waiting for others to lead. This nation is the world's foremost manufacturer, farmer, banker, consumer, and exporter. The common market is moving ahead at an economic growth rate twice ours. The communist economic offensive is underway. The opportunity is ours. The initiative is up to us. And I believe that 1962 is the time. To seize that initiative, I shall shortly send to the Congress a new 5-year trade expansion act, far-reaching in scope, but designed with great care to make certain that its benefits to our people far outweigh any risks. The bill will permit the gradual elimination of tariffs here in the United States and in the common market on those items in which we together supply 80% of the world's trade, mostly items in which our own ability to compete is demonstrated by the fact that we sell abroad in these items substantially more than we import. This step will make it possible for our major industries to compete with their counterparts in Western Europe for access to European consumers. On the other hand, the bill will permit a gradual reduction of duties up to 50%, permitting bargaining by major categories, and provide for appropriate and tested forms of assistance to firms and employees adjusting to import competition. We are not neglecting the safeguards provided by peril points and escape clause or the National Security Amendment, nor are we abandoning our non-European friends or our traditional most favored nation principle. On the contrary, the bill will provide new encouragement for their sale of tropical agricultural products so important to our friends in Latin America who have long depended upon the European market, and who now find themselves faced with new challenges which we must join with them in overcoming. Concessions in this bargaining must, of course, be reciprocal, not unilateral. The common market will not fulfill its own high promise unless its outside tariff walls are low. The dangers of restriction or timidity in our own policy have counterparts for our friends in Europe. For together we face a common challenge to enlarge the prosperity of free men everywhere, to build in partnership a new trading community in which all free nations may gain from the productive energy of free competitive effort. These various elements in our foreign policy lead, as I have said, to a single goal, the goal of a peaceful world of free and independent states. This is our guide for the present and our vision for the future. A free community of nations, independent but interdependent, uniting North and South, East and West, in one great family of man, outgrowing and transcending the hates and fears that rend our age. We will not reach that goal today or tomorrow. We may not reach it in our lifetime, but the quest is the great adventure of our century. We sometimes chafe at the burdens of our obligations, the complexity of our decisions, the agony of our choices, but there is no comfort or security for us in evasion, no solution in abdication, no relief in irresponsibility. A year ago, in assuming the task of the presidency, I said that few generations in all history had been granted the role of being the great defender of freedom in its hour of maximum danger. This is our good fortune, and I welcome it now, as I did a year ago. For it is the fate of this generation, of you in the Congress, and of me as president, to live with a struggle we did not start, in a world we did not make. But the pressures of life are not always distributed by choice. And while no nation has ever faced such a challenge, no nation has ever been so ready to seize the burden and the glory of freedom. And in this high endeavor, may God watch over the United States of America.